The Vet Tech Cafe is a podcast centered around veterinary technicians and nurses. We strive to discuss current issues facing our profession and give our colleagues a voice and a medium to enter into these discussions. Our guests are experts in the veterinary field that we hope can help our listeners work towards dealing with these issues, as well as coming up with solutions that can lead to change. If you have a question or a comment for us, please contact us at vettechcafe@gmail.com. And now, here are Dave, Jeff, and another amazing guest on the Vet Tech Cafe.
Good morning, everybody. Thank you for coming by the Vet Tech Cafe today. Dave, how are you? What's new?
I'm doing great. The veterinary tech program that I'm working for now has finally done with finals. I'm in like that little lull of not having exams to write, lesson plans to start. I've got like a little 3-week break. We don't start classes again until the 13th.
You're one of those rare veterinary technicians that gets a Christmas vacation.
Yes. Yeah. I'm not used to that. And, you know, it's for the last 15, 20 years, I've had to decide, am I working Christmas? Am I working Christmas Eve? Am I working New Year's? And now I don't have to do that.
Right.
It's kind of a nice thing.
Yeah. You know, we were chatting before we started recording today about the article that's kind of making its rounds through the through social media. It was originally published in Veterinary Practice News about the idea of a VNA, what would be like a veterinary nurse associate, right?
Right.
Kind of like the either analogous to a nurse practitioner or a physician's assistant in human medicine. And
right.
Some really interesting thoughts. And this article was originally written by a veterinarian, and you know, some really interesting numbers in there, some really interesting ideas. But what are your thoughts on that?
They're suggesting making a VNA, which is kind of confusing because we call vet nurse assistants a VNA now. So that already creates some confusion.
Right.
But what they're wanting to do is create something like a physician's assistant where they can do exams and they can do diagnostic testing, write prescriptions, things like that, which the argument against that is, why are we not using technicians to do that? And, you know, we went through some of the talking points of it, and there was a response in the December issue from a veterinary technician that said, basically, why are we reinventing the wheel? We already have technician programs that require testing, licensing, CE requirements, things like that, where you could be utilizing veterinary technicians to do all these things. You don't really need to have a separate program to create another position that technically isn't really needed. And, you know, the author kind of had a response to that, and basically what they did is it says that they checked with the founder of a veterinary technician program, which to me says your sample size is one. Your sample size is a founder of a vet tech program, not necessarily a program director or a teacher. It's somebody that started a vet tech program, which that leads us to think, well, how far removed is this? Is this somebody that started a program 15 years ago? Is it someone that started 2 years ago? But regardless,
right.
The author says that the confusing part is they're saying what the founder of the vet tech program said was that a physical exam is briefly touched on, emphasis placed on restraint, taking RADs, lab methods, things like that. Whereas this VNA position, they want to have more years of college to focus more on physical exams and being able to tell the difference between different heart murmurs and being able to write prescriptions, which, you know, the argument here, and I think we'll probably get into this with our guest today, is that if you have someone with an advanced certification like a VTS, a veterinary technician specialist, we can do all those things, and we
right.
already do all those things.
Right.
I mean, obviously we don't write prescriptions, but most of the stuff is stuff we already do. So why are we creating another position in a field that's already starved for workers? Like the vet tech population is very low right now.
Yeah.
Why are we creating a separate position for something that we could be actually utilizing our technicians? You know, we talked about this with Ed Carlson the last episode about the vet tech utilization task force. Why are we not using our techs for things that they can do and want to do?
Yeah.
As opposed to creating a whole new position. It just doesn't make sense.
Right. And I mean, to be clear, like this is, you know, just one veterinarian's idea. And I do love, you know, that they're, you know, wanting to bring the level of technicians up, and it just, you know, another idea and, you know, creates good discussion. I think my thought would be, until we kind of get the infrastructure a little bit more solid in terms of veterinary technicians, right? Getting a unified
right.
title and having it be recognized in all 50 states, like until we actually get some of those things hashed out, we really shouldn't. And actually even getting VTS in practice acts and actually making
right.
an understanding of what that is and what they can do. I don't know that we need to be muddying the waters even further. And I worry that, you know, I know there are a lot of states already that in some way have some kind of certified veterinary assistant program. It's either put on, you know, by the VMAs or whatever it may be. I know that's what it is in California. But it, but to in the eyes of the Veterinary Medical Board, it really doesn't mean anything. It's yeah. just, you know, it's a class. It's got some classroom hours. It's got some externship hours, and you're a certified veterinary assistant, which is great. It's fantastic. But it's still like, it was somebody's idea, and I think they threw some stuff together. But in the legal realm, it still doesn't hold any water.
Right.
And until we kind of get some of this stuff hashed out, I don't think we need to be adding even more fields or titles or anything. I think it's just a little bit too soon. I mean, I like the idea of having something like that, but I think, like you said, we already have probably somebody that can fulfill that role in the VTS. And sure, if you want to require that they have a master's degree in veterinary science or something to fulfill these kind of duties or something, like then we can, you know, have some of those discussions or what have you. But I feel like they already have the advanced knowledge and skill sets to maybe do some of that. And as you said, I think it ties in really well with our guest today. And our guest today coming by the Vet Tech Cafe is Liza Rudolph, who's a VTS in both canine feline clinical practice and small animal internal medicine. And it'll be great to get her thoughts on that too. And, you know, just kind of see. And I just think we're not quite there yet. We still got some work to do.
Well, and my thought was, and we'll talk to her about this, is that who better to do this task than a VTS in clinical practice?
Right.
I'm not 100% sure about everything that's involved in that VTS. We'll ask her about it.
And we'll find out today.
It seems like it's something that would fall right into their hands.
Yeah. So I guess without further ado, we'll bring on Liza. So Liza has been working as a veterinary technician for 20 years. She's a VTS, a veterinary technician specialist in canine feline clinical practice and in small animal internal medicine. She provides education and training to veterinary technicians as both webinar instructor for Penn Foster, lecturing at conferences, other online continuing education opportunities, and has also published lots of articles. When she's not teaching, she's an active member of multiple veterinary organizations and practices as a relief veterinary technician. Might be something else to ask her about, because I know a lot of technicians ask about how to get started in doing relief, spending most of her clinical time in specialty practices in the Mid-Atlantic and in the Midwest. So Liza, thanks for coming by today. Welcome to the Vet Tech Cafe.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm so pleased to be here.
it's a little early for me on a Saturday morning. So how do you like your coffee or your caffeinated beverage of choice?
Well, that's actually perfect timing, because I usually start my day with some hot tea. I ease myself into my caffeination, and I've just finished my cup of tea, so I am ready for coffee.
And how would you take your coffee?
I'm feeling festive, so I'm sure there will be comments about this, but I'm going for an eggnog latte, Jeff.
Yeah.
Terrible.
Molly made a pot of eggnog coffee this morning, so that's exactly what I'm drinking.
Fantastic.
Just, yeah. Dave, what are you having?
Coffee with cream and sugar. That's it.
All right. Fair enough.
Black silk.
So Liza, we always kind of start off with our guest career path. So kind of talk about where you started or how you got your start, and kind of go through, you know, you're working your way up in your VTSs and kind of what you're working on now.
Sure thing. How did things start? So I definitely, like I think many people, didn't know that veterinary technology was a thing. I knew that throughout high school and college that I liked science, I liked animals, and I also thought about human medicine, but I couldn't quite make that leap. I knew I didn't want to be an MD, for example, but I couldn't figure out how to get science and healthcare and animals together, because I didn't want to be a vet. But I didn't know technicians existed. It's actually funny. I think it was a year after I graduated high school, I ran into an English teacher who was my favorite teacher at my high school. And after we talked for a few minutes, he asked what I was doing. And of course I said, well, I'm kind of doing my general ed, but I'm an undeclared major. And that's when he said, have you considered veterinary technology? And he introduced me to the entire profession, which is random. You know, as a high school English teacher.
Yeah.
But he was super smart. He had a farm, and he had tons of goats, and he knew, because there was a veterinarian that came out when they did house calls, and that vet had a veterinary technician. So that's how he knew. So that kind of got my brain brain primed, and I started out at Harcum College in Bryn Mawr, Pennsylvania, and unfortunately had to move before I finished the program, and I moved down to Florida. And when I moved down to Florida, it really became clear that, at least in the environment and at that time, that there really wasn't a push for education. And if I'm going to be completely honest, I was very much counseled to not go to school to get my credentials, because it was worth it, but it wasn't worth it by multiple veterinarians. And to be fair, at that time and in that state, it wouldn't have gotten me anything special. It really wouldn't have. So I'm not necessarily throwing those veterinarians under the bus, because they were looking out for me. They thought they were recommending the right thing. But it wasn't until I moved back to the area and I moved back to Pennsylvania and I decided I kind of wanted more, and I didn't really know what that more was. So I ended up at a specialty practice, and I started out working with the surgery team. And eventually we had a new internist that was coming on board. And because I had general practice experience at this point, they thought I would be a great fit for internal medicine, because I knew how to basically run exam rooms and talk to people, which is most of the techs in this practice weren't doing any of those things. They were kind of all in the back. I took that opportunity and worked in internal medicine for about a year before I decided that this was my thing. I finally found my thing. And then I realized, well, if I want a VTS, because at that time the internal medicine VTS was fairly new, that I actually needed to become credentialed. So that was actually the catalyst for me to sit for the VTNE, which I initially did through an alternative route through Delaware, because I was so impatient to get those letters, because I wanted that specialty.
I went through Delaware myself.
I was
licensed. I've said this before. I was licensed in Delaware, even though I'd spent exactly 24 hours in Delaware.
I remember I drove down to Dover to take the exam.
Me too.
Yeah, that was before computer testing, guys, for those of you that are listening. There was a Scantron sheet. Oh, yes, I remember it very well.
Those dreaded Scantrons.
Yes, but I got my LVT in Delaware in 2008. And then at that time, I also realized, by studying through the alternative route, it became clear to me that there were definite holes in my knowledge. You know, even though I was kind of always that go-getter person in the clinic that was always attending CE and reading all the articles and all of the things, I realized that there were gaps. So that prompted me to go back to school, and I enrolled at St. Pete and eventually graduated St. Petersburg with my associates and then ultimately my bachelor's in veterinary technology. So I kind of did the bachelor's and the VTS thing all wrapped up into one, which was fun.
Almost sounds like you did things kind of backwards. Where you?
I did.
You did the VTNE, and then you got your degree.
Yes, I did. So 2008, I had my LVT in Delaware, and then in 2009 is when I graduated from St. Pete. Because of course, I did have some credits from Harcum that did transfer over, and all my general ed was finished. So
Since you've gone from having your VTS in small animal internal medicine, and now you have clinical practice as well, canine and feline. So kind of talk about that, because you were one of the founding members of that VTS. Is that correct?
That is correct.
So I've kind of toyed with the idea of whether or not starting a VTS in toxicology would be beneficial to anybody. But what was that like in terms of starting a VTS? Like how did that look like?
It was interesting, because so this conversation about starting a clinical practice VTS started in 2008. And if you remember the timeline, that's pretty much right when I was becoming credentialed and becoming, you know, a technician. But I had all these years of experience prior. And at the time, with VTS formation, there wasn't strict guidelines on when your experience starts. Does it start when you're credentialed, or is it all of your experience?
Right.
And all of that experience from 2000 to 2008, I should say 2006, was all general practice. So I had the experience to qualify as an organizing committee member. And I remember I saw a press release come out, and it came out, I think I saw it through NAVTA. I think it was printed in the journal. And I reached out to this group that was soliciting for clinical practice. veterinary technicians. And I thought, what a fantastic idea, because here's this group of technicians. And I'm sure that any of you that have worked in general practice or know some of these rock star technicians, that there are really highly skilled, highly knowledgeable veterinary technicians in general practice.
Yeah.
And knowing that veterinary technicians kind of, even though we didn't have the data at the time, we knew technicians were getting burnout. We knew that there wasn't longevity in the field, just intuitively. We knew that. So how do we give back and provide an outlet for these technicians to continue to be engaged, to still love their work? Because if your passion is wellness, then go for it. That's great. We need more rock star technicians in wellness and in preventative medicine. So we really started building the clinical practice VTS. I believe there were, for the canine feline specialty, we had, I want to say, between 6 and 8 organizing committee members, but we also were developing other subspecialties. So we had an exotics group, and we had 4 exotics technicians with tons of experience. And we also had a group for production medicine. So like I said, we were just trying to reach out to those multidisciplinary technicians that really don't spend the majority of their time doing, let's say, anesthesia or dentistry or surgery or behavior. They're kind of doing all of the things all of the time. Right. So the goal was a multidisciplinary VTS that would really encompass what these high functioning technicians were doing every single day in GP.
Okay.
Yeah. So talk a little bit about what the clinical practice, because it's kind of a general term, isn't it? You kind of touched on it already, where it's more geared towards people working in general practice.
Yes.
But what's involved? Like, how many skills do they need? Like, what type of skills do they have? What type of knowledge base do they have to have?
I sort of explain it to people in that if you were to take the VTNE and you were to pull out everything in regards to a particular species, it really is a species-oriented, generalized specialty. And then take that level of knowledge and ramp it up is really kind of what we were looking for in terms of developing that VTS. Yeah, and multidisciplinary. So the skills list, there's definitely, for the canine feline, there's a category on anesthesia, on surgery, on behavior, on dentistry, even on practice management, because we know that a lot of these technicians, especially in family or general practice, the more time you spend there, the more responsibilities you get. You get promoted by the virtue of the fact that you're a devoted employee, right? And you've worked there for a long time.
Right.
So knowing that they were taking on roles like, you know, inventory and monitoring controlled drugs, so we threw those in as skills because that's what they're doing every day. It's a little bit of everything kind of all wrapped up, but at a VTS level, we're really looking for VTS level candidates.
Gotcha. And so you mentioned there was multiple species. So there's canine feline, there's avian exotics as well. Is that correct?
Yes. So the three initial specialties that we developed were canine feline, which was obviously the biggest because that's the majority of what the technicians are practicing is the small animal medicine. And it initially was at avian exotics, which has since been renamed to exotic companion animal, which separates them from zoo med or wildlife, because ultimately exotic companion animals are not tigers. So we're looking for pets, right?
In theory.
Companion animals. And then there was production medicine. And a lot of the people that were involved in that were coming from Purdue, which really isn't a big surprise in terms of the knowledge and the production medicine that's out there. And
Does production medicine, does that mean like livestock?
Yes. Okay. Yes. Okay. And, you know, and that could encompass the cows, whether we're talking beef or dairy, sheep, pigs, that sort of thing, with the goal of more of a herd health and production, right? These are animals that have a job to produce something.
Right.
Yes. So those were the three initial categories. And then we discussed adding other categories. And the one that we most recently added is feline only. Time went on, it really became apparent that there are these feline-only techs that's all they do day in, day out, and they're specialized within a particular species. And we kept getting people asking about, when are you coming out with feline only? So finally, we did add that. We have yet to sit our first exam for feline only VTS, but it is available. We also talked about adding shelter medicine as a subcategory. Oh. And the whole reason that came about is because our mentor veterinary college, so recognized veterinary specialty organization that is kind of our mentor organization, is the American Board of Veterinary Practitioners. And they also are multidisciplinary, species-oriented specialties. And a few years ago, they added shelter medicine to their umbrella. So we figured that if we're sort of mirroring their attempts and their goals, that if we had shelter medicine, maybe we could put it under our umbrella. Unfortunately, we're just finding it difficult to find people for the organizing committee that really are qualified as the guidelines that are laid out by NAFTA. It's something we're considering. If we find the right people, we could potentially do it.
Interesting. I know a few shelter techs that would probably super dig that. It just, again, like I can only imagine the mountain it is to put that together.
Yeah.
It took years, I'm not going to lie, to put together a new VTS. It was hard, but I've definitely met some of the professional connections that I've made and the friends that I've made through the formation of the VTS. It definitely bonds you to one another, for sure.
Yeah, sure, yeah.
Yes.
So let's kind of go back to what Jeff and I were talking about in the beginning of the show, about this article about creating the VNA Vet Nurse Associate position. So it sounds like the VTS in clinical practice would be perfectly matched to do all these things that this doctor is proposing that they create. What are your thoughts on that?
I agree. I think it's interesting. I did read the article and I read it again more recently. And reading through it, what it really sent home to me was more that it seems that most veterinarians, or at least the veterinarian that wrote this, didn't understand what the scope of practice of a veterinary technician is.
Right.
And like you were saying, that a lot of the things that he listed we could do, we already can do. So it's a little bit interesting. But I think that you're right in terms of the clinical practice VTS, especially those that are working in these wellness practices, as most of our members are, this is perfect for them. And these are things that they're frankly doing, it, if not all of these things, many of these things every single day already.
Well, besides writing prescriptions.
Correct.
Right?
That would be the one exception.
The one thing.
Right. Maybe you could also argue vaccinations if in your state rabies has to be given by a veterinarian.
Right.
But ultimately, we're already doing all of the things within the Practice Act.
And I think in that initial article, they said that they would be paid roughly half of what a veterinarian would make. And I'm like, wow, if I was just coming out of school making half of what a vet make, I would be so happy. you know, how many years have we worked to get up to even close to that? And now they're just saying, oh, do a couple more years of school and you can make
that much
more money. It's something we talked about with Ed Carlson about underutilization of technicians and, you know, underpaid and all these things. Whereas proposing something that just leapfrogs over all of that, which just seems, if we're trying to make better use of our technicians, why are we essentially taking that skill away from them by saying, you don't get to do this now. This other group of people that weren't technicians, weren't assistants, coming right out of school are now going to be do this. It just seems kind of counterintuitive.
Yeah.
I completely agree. I appreciate the support in that, you know, having another avenue for technicians and trying to keep them in the field working as a team with your veterinarians. That I appreciate that spirit of the article. I just think the execution is lacking.
Yeah. And I mean, I do think a lot of people know that a physician's assistant title exists or knows that a nurse practitioner title exists. I don't think they really have a great understanding of what those are and how that could compare to what could be done in our field. I think about, you know, not just general practice and a clinical practice VTS, but even in an ER, you know, a VTS and ECC could fulfill some of those roles. If the shelter medicine ever came to pass, VTS and shelter medicine ever came to pass, they could fulfill some of those roles in a shelter. And there are multiple like places where that could absolutely work. I just don't think we're there yet in the comparisons to those two fields in human medicine, which are actually quite different, nurse practitioner and a physician's assistant. I think we're just not quite there yet.
Yeah.
Right. I would definitely agree. And it is interesting too, you know, when you're looking at the article goes on to specify specifically that some of these tasks that are given as examples in the article, that they would be under DVM direct supervision, which is just interesting because depending on what task we're talking about, some of the practice acts at this point don't even require direct supervision for some of these things that he's listing. It's actually indirect supervision. So it's just kind of interesting where this advanced practice degree or mid-level professional, where they would actually fit in, like you all said, that we're already doing these things anyway.
Right.
And it seems like what he's describing is a physician's assistant. So the whole nurse practitioner versus physician's assistant, which this article actually prompted me to look into the difference, because I knew there was a difference, but I didn't quite understand what the difference was. Mm. And that physician's assistants really go more under the medical knowledge or the medical model. So these people that want to be a physician's assistant are usually going to school at a med school, and it's more of a generalist education versus a nurse practitioner. Their education is more in the nursing tradition, which really involves looking at the patient holistically as a whole person and evaluating their overall wellness. So there is a difference between a medical model and a nursing model. And also in a lot of states, these nurse practitioners actually have greater autonomy often than the physician's assistant.
Really?
Yes. And also those nurse practitioners have a really specific population. For example, maybe they work specifically in neonatal medicine or something like that, whereas a physician's assistant, as I mentioned, is generalist education. And it used to be thought that you would have more flexibility without this narrow focus, right? So maybe I become a physician's assistant and I work in a particular practice doing a certain thing. Well, since I'm not restricted by any specialty, I could potentially change over time. But what they're finding is that as time goes on, they don't like people switching specialties because they don't want to start all over again. So it is kind of interesting, but, you know, and also the scope of practice, depending on each state, the scope of practice is going to be different on a physician's assistant versus a nurse practitioner. But ultimately, both of them are independently licensed providers, and they function independently of physicians. So it seems like we're kind of cherry picking certain things from different professions and making it, what was it called? A veterinary
nurse associate.
Veterinary nurse associate. So it's kind of like combining all of those things from advanced practice degrees for nursing. So it is kind of interesting.
Yeah. The weird part is it says we're going to be doing physical exams, prescribing medications, and ordering diagnostics, which, I mean,
right,
in the grand scope of what a technician does every day, that's like, what is that, like 2% of what we actually do? You know, you're trying to take a very small portion of what we actually do as technicians and then giving it to one person to do all of that stuff, which it just seems like, yeah, that would probably be less of a burden on us as technicians, but it's something that we can do. We don't need another person in the practice to do that. We need more technicians. We need more staff, not just someone to do one portion of what we do.
Right. No, I absolutely agree. And one of the other things that was listed in the article was routine, being able to manage basic emergency situations or routine injuries. And it specifically mentions fight wounds that don't require surgery. I'm not entirely sure what that means, because if we're not doing surgery, but we're addressing wounds, I mean, is that just a clip and clean and a bandage? Because we do that all day, every day.
Yeah.
So,
and, you know, I think one other thing too, and I obviously don't mean to go down this path and open up this can of worms, but the title, right? I mean, assumes that vet nurse someday actually goes through, you know, I mean, sure, you could just interchange vet tech associate, but it's interesting that that this veterinarian chose vet nurse associate,
yeah,
I think.
Right.
As well.
And I think maybe that goes to combining that nurse practitioner and physician's assistant. Like we kind of melded them, together a little bit. Yeah.
Sounds just like vet med. Take two different disciplines and combine the title and make it one, and away we go.
Right, exactly. Agreed. This isn't a conversation about titles and so forth, but I do know that there's a couple of individual specialty practices and some universities that they have a job title that they call their technicians nurse practitioners. And regardless of the nurse word, right? Because that's a whole other conversation. But to me, that's taking a title from human medicine that involves a master's degree and a whole lot of training in specific areas. And we're just taking that title and we're giving it to people that more often than not, they're not going to have a master's degree. There's very few technicians that have master's degrees.
Right.
Probably not a bachelor's, and maybe they have an associate's. That just intuitively makes me uncomfortable.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Kind of, I guess, sticking in this vein of education. So you mentioned when you were going through your career path, you actually did both associates and bachelors through St. Petersburg. Is that correct?
I did.
So what was so I know in my time in Southern California, Cal Poly Pomona had a 4-year vet tech degree, and it was in California. You became, if you got that degree, you were an RVTG.
Yes, correct.
And so what additional education was in the 4 years? Like what was different about that?
Sure. So for St. Pete, the bachelor's program is what they call a 2+2 program. So the expectation is that you go through your associate's degree in veterinary technology. And as long as it's AVMA approved, that essentially will count as your first 2 years of your bachelor's.
Okay.
It's a little bit different in that the general education requirements for an associate versus a bachelor's are different. So it's likely that if you're coming from a traditional vet tech program, that when you transfer into a bachelor's program, you're probably going to have to take a few extra electives. I remember I had to take speech, I took statistics, and I believe a music course, because why not? But, you know, you round out that education and then you roll into those that last 2 years. A lot of people have questions about the difference, what the content is. And as far as St. Pete specifically, they had two different tracks. So when you go in through the bachelor's program, you can choose to either follow the clinical track, the practice management track, or actually a combination of the two. So you can build it to where you think your career is going or where you want your career to go. And I really liked that concept that I could build it, because ultimately, I didn't want to be a practice manager, but I still had interest in leadership. So I knew a lot of this, the subject matter that was going to be in the practice management track probably wasn't going to be applicable to me. So what I ended up doing was following the clinical track. And then when there were electives, I chose leadership courses to kind of augment that. But they take a deeper dive into safety. They take a deeper dive into pharmacology, as well as anesthesia, surgical nursing, a deeper dive into companion animal diseases, because I was small animal. So companion animal diseases and small animal nursing. But as far as some of the electives, they had a really great emergency critical care course. They had a dentistry course, which I didn't take because dentistry is not my bag. I love the people that love dentistry, but that's not my bag. They even had a course specifically for ophthalmology technicians. So if you were working in specialty, you could really tailor it to what you wanted to learn. I think one of my favorite courses, aside from the emergency and critical care, because it was a really great course, was also the fact that they had an integrative nursing course. So this was your complementary medicine, which work at the time I was working in internal medicine, but we also had a fair degree of oncology cases. So we had a lot of people that really wanted to treat naturally, and I didn't feel that I was remotely educated to have any kind of discussion with these people about vitamins and mushrooms and immunostimulants and all of these other things. So that course was particularly helpful because I feel like I have a better understanding of complementary medicine, which was helpful, even though I couldn't maybe talk about all of the things because it was just one course. I definitely had a better handle on it, and it definitely affected the particular clients that I was seeing in specialty medicine.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Yes, it was a lot of fun. So it was a good combination between clinical and, like I said, some of the management, some of the leadership and legal and ethical considerations and that sort of thing. So it was a great fit for me.
Awesome. And so now you do some teaching through Penn Foster, right? A different online.
I do. I am a webinar instructor for Penn Foster. So I teach a course for VTNE review and also a nutrition course as well.
That's great. Awesome.
Yeah, it's tons of fun. I love it.
Jeff and I are going to be teaching a course through VSPN. I've never done the webinar thing, and Jeff's already done it, but we're doing that. I don't know when that starts, Jeff. Do you know when that starts?
Sometime in 2020. They haven't given us dates yet.
Okay.
Gotcha.
Yeah, so that'll be something new for me.
Yeah, I find it to be a lot of fun, and it all, you know, the most difficult thing with webinars is trying to keep people engaged, but as long as that's forefront on your mind,
yeah,
you can definitely make it work. I have a lot of fun. I really, really enjoy the webinars.
That's great. I'm looking forward to getting into that. So Liza, what is East Coast Veterinary Education?
Great question. So East Coast Veterinary Education, or as I call it, ECVE, because we like acronyms, right?
We
in
love
veterinary
acronyms.
Medicine. Everything's an initial. So
everything.
Over at ECVE, that is an LLC that myself and a colleague, Joe DeFulio, actually founded specifically for really being able to go out and provide training and education to area practices. And I usually handle most of the nursing topics, and Joe handles a lot of the practice management topics and leadership. So And Joe also has some compassion fatigue certification. So we've kind of done a divide and conquer to try to provide the most balanced education we can and really bring up the level of veterinary practices in the area.
That's great. So you go physically to practices, not like an online thing.
Correct. Yes. We have done a couple of webinars. Mm-hmm. It's fun and it's easy. and you get good outreach, right? From the comfort of your living room. But yes, we've gone in practices, and I will say that the biggest draw that brings us into practices is actually CPR certification.
Ah, yes. Yeah, you're also a recovery instructor, correct?
I am, yes. Yeah.
I just recently got my Recover Instructor certification at IVEX this year, so I'm excited to get into that too.
That's awesome.
And so how can people get in contact with you about training?
So a couple of different ways. We are pretty good as far as our Facebook messages. We do have a presence on Facebook and Instagram, but also there is a contact form directly through the website, which is eastcoastveterinaryeducation.com. And it's been a lot of fun. I think it's one of our favorite things is to do Recover certification.
Yep.
Because, I mean, first of all, getting people up and moving and doing CPR, it's just fun on these mannequins. It's just fun. But also, it's something to add to your resume. It's something to feel more confident in, particularly in an area that's very stressful when it happens, right? So anything we can do to reduce that stress. But also, one of the reasons that I really like it is that when we come in these practices, it's often not just the veterinarians, it's not just the technicians, it's not just the assistants, it's, you know, potentially also your customer service reps, because ultimately we're teaching CPR, and as long as we're, you know, sticking to basic, for example, basic life support, there's no reason you can't teach anyone how to do proper compressions.
Absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely.
So it kind of turns into team building, because you're bringing all these people together that are separated from the front and the back and the exam rooms and the surgery, and you bring them all together and they have to save this mannequin.
Yeah.
And they do it. And it's fantastic. I really, really enjoy it.
Well, and you think about too, in the human world, anybody, any human can go take a class in human CPR.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So why not have everybody in your practice be at least BLS certified and be able to help out? I mean, you know, if you have that emergency on the lunch hour where maybe a bunch of people are gone and it's just one or two people, have a third person that can come back and cycle in. It's just, why not? Why not?
Exactly.
What kind of other popular training type stuff do you have when you go into these practices? I mean, obviously, like, Recover is a big one, but like, what other kind of things do you focus on?
Recover is a big one. One of the other most popular from my perspective is something called the nursing process, which is taken from human medicine, and really it's employing critical thinking so that you're evaluating your patient as a whole. And it's particularly helpful in ICU and inpatient environments, and also for those new grads, right? To have a new graduate technician and plunk them in the middle of the ICU and expect them to intuitively know all of the things that you've gained over years of experience is really difficult. So having an actual process and a plan and something that's actually on paper can really help them learn how to optimize inpatient care fairly quickly, and make it less overwhelming. So that topic is popular. And believe it or not, I know you guys are both emergency critical care, but one of my other most popular topics is actually immunology and vaccination.
Oh boy.
Because a lot of people forget those concepts of immunology and why we vaccinate the way we do. And once, you know, it's not something, especially in general practice, when an owner comes in and they ask you, why did I get this card through the mail that says I need XYZ vaccines, that your answer shouldn't be because the doctor said so.
Right.
And it shouldn't be because that's our protocol. You should actually be able to answer, because then the client's going to have faith that you know what you're doing, that you're not just checking off boxes, that it's actually tailored to their particular pet. So taking a deep dive into immunology and vaccination actually is really interesting.
It's not for me, but I can absolutely understand why that's important.
Yeah, Robin was showing me something on Facebook about this doctor that was promoting that we're over vaccinating our patients, and then they did some people did some research into the guy that was doing all this and realizing that he was giving half doses of vaccines, and he lost his license and all this other stuff. So, and Robin is immunologically, how do I say that word?
Immunologically.
That word.
Yes.
She's very focused because that's one of her many degrees.
Oh, fantastic.
So yes. Kind of switching topics a little bit. I saw on your CV that you are QPR certified.
I am.
What is that? And how can others get involved in that? Because that as I looked into that, I'm like, that's something that I think I want to do as well.
Yes. So QPR training is through what's called the QPR Institute. And QPR stands for Question, Persuade, and Refer. So really what it's focusing on is empowering people to have that conversation with people that you may have concern about their mental wellness. Because a lot of people, if you get that feeling that you're concerned about their well-being, a lot of people don't know how to have that conversation, or, you know, we just kind of go in denial, like, oh, I'm sure they're fine, we're just not going to address it. But statistically, you know, we have research that says that if you have that concern and if somebody's thinking about it, that it's better to ask about it than to ignore it. You can actually save lives. So I felt that with the issue with wellness in the veterinary profession, having personally lost people from the veterinary profession, I think it's important to be able to recognize those signs. And granted, I don't have an advanced degree in social work or anything like that, but having the tools to be able to have that conversation to potentially get them to where they need to go to save that life, I think that's a really important tool in the toolbox for us.
Yeah, and that's something that we're trying to bring to our listeners is, you know, suicide prevention is a big topic right now. And mm-hmm. the more access we have to tools to help prevent this,
right.
Like we talked about this a lot with Liz Houston, and
yes.
To get through all that stuff, and, you know, even if we save one life, you know, it's totally worth it. You know, the certification kind of, I guess it runs you through, like, questions to ask.
It does. And it really does kind of, as I mentioned, drive home that point that if you ask someone if they're having suicidal thoughts, you're not putting that idea into their head. This
right.
is something they're already thinking about. So if you have that concern that you're going to question, right, that's the first part. You question that person about suicide. Are you having negative thoughts? Do you have these feelings? How long have you had these feelings? And really stressing that it's okay to have that question. And then depending on how they answer, then you move to the P part. You're trying to persuade that person to get help.
Right.
And listen to them, you know, let me get help. Come with me. Let me help you find, you know, the support that you need. And, you know, some of those questions, like you mentioned, are important how you phrase them. Saying something like, oh, anything I can do to help, just let me know. That's, while the intent is good, someone who doesn't know what they want and they're in a bad place, they don't know how you can help them. So yeah. You kind of have to drive the bus, so to speak, in terms of that.
Well, and I'll be honest, right now, that's what I do say. If I'm concerned about somebody, I'm like, anything I can do, let me know.
Right. And we mean it from a point of, right. really, anything, just let me know, I'm here for you. But when you're not in that right mental place, you
right.
can't even process what you need. Most times you can't
yeah.
process that. And then ultimately, after questioning and persuading, is the actual referring them for help, whether that's psychologist, a teacher, a counselor, religious support, whatever is appropriate for that person, actually getting them to where they need to go. And again, it's more than just, oh, here's this guy that I know, you should go talk to him. You know, actually saying, we're going to go to the guy
yeah.
together.
Yeah.
Right.
And making sure that they get the help. So really, it's sort of a first line, and it kind of fits in perfectly as a segue from talking about, you know, recover and CPR, and then talking about QPR, because
yeah.
really, that's what we're doing. We're doing an initial triage. We're trying to save a life, but we're focused on mental health instead of physical health.
Oh, that's a great point. That's fantastic.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. How does somebody find this kind of training? Like, do they just Google QPR training, or are there places that actually, like, do this, you know, like an institution you recommend or that you've gone through, or how do people actually find doing this?
So the best way that you can find information is qprtraining.com. So that'll take you to the QPR
perfect.
Institute. And the training that I did was sort of the what I just explained, but a little bit more in depth, but
sure.
You know, but that's sort of their basic, I don't want to say catch-all recommendation, but in anybody, whether we're talking about health professions, or maybe we're talking about a defense attorney, or, you know, what, for whatever reason, you can have this conversation with everybody, but they also have other courses that are more tailored to healthcare. They're tailored to law enforcement. They're tailored to lawyers. So, which
this
is
isn't
interesting.
This isn't a veterinary thing. This is
this
overall
correct.
Okay.
It is.
Wow.
Yes.
Wow.
Yes.
That's great. Well, yeah. and we'll get that up on our page, and when we post the write up about this episode, we'll put all those links on that stuff in there as well.
Wonderful. Yeah. Wonderful.
Well, I think our time is just about up today. It's amazing how fast an hour goes.
Yeah, it does.
Thank you so much for coming by today, Liza. We really appreciate your time.
Oh, it was my pleasure. This is so much fun.
we have one last, probably the hardest question.
Oh dear.
Of the day, just a random question, and for our listeners out there, again, please send us random off the wall questions to ask our guests, and we got one in the mail this week that we'll be asking in a future episode that is pretty out there. I'm excited to bring that one out. But for you today, what is the most ridiculous fact you know?
I'm going to be completely honest and say that I'm pretty sure I know a ton of ridiculous facts for no good reason, and most of them are pretty nerd related. I'm going to have to go with Legos, okay? So, do you guys happen to know what the largest commercially available Lego set is?
No clue, but I'm no idea.
But I know, right? And that's the whole point, right? So in October of 2017, they released the Millennium Falcon, which is the largest version of the Millennium Falcon that they released. It has over 7,500 pieces.
Dang.
It's 8 inches high. It's 33 inches long. And it cost about $800.
Holy cow.
So that is the most ridiculous thing that I can just pull out of my brain for no good reason whatsoever.
Well, you even know when it was like released
and
stuff?
Yeah,
I do. And no good reason why. No, no good reason.
I am actually going to Google largest Lego Millennium Falcon when this is over and look at the pictures.
It's fantastic. I can send you a picture of me next to one because that's the level of that's how high I wave my nerd flag at times. So yes. So
maybe we'll have to use that as your picture for the episode.
Yeah, maybe.
You absolutely can. I can also send you a YouTube link. They did a quick little trailer when it came out, like showing people how to. It was sort of like an animated version of it all coming together, and it looks like a movie trailer. It's fantastic.
Oh my gosh, that's awesome. That's
so
awesome.
Liza, you said that's nerd knowledge. Is that nerd knowledge because you're a Lego nerd or a Star Wars nerd?
I'm just, it's a little bit everything.
A little bit everything?
Yes. And I also make a point in my Penn Foster webinars, in terms of engagement, during all of my webinars, there's always a nerd poll. and it usually, it could do with Lego, Star Wars, Star Trek, because that's a really good conversation to have. Sometimes it's books, it's movies, it's video games, and yeah, it's a lot of fun.
that's great. A great idea. I'm gonna have to file that one away from myself.
Yeah, nerd poll. Yeah. Nerd poll. Yes.
All right. Well, thanks again for your time today. We really appreciate you taking the time out and stopping by for a cup of coffee at the Vet Tech Cafe. A lot of really great insight today, and we'll post the links for the QPR training, and we'll post links for ECVE.
Yes, and, please.
it was great to chat, and hopefully we get to see you at some event or conference or something sometime soon. I know we'll both be at IVEX. I don't know if we'll both be at anything before that, but we'll at least hope to see you then.
Yes, we'll definitely be crossing paths at some point in 2020 for sure.
Yeah, that's great. All right. Thanks again. We'll talk to you later.
All right. Thank you. Bye.
Thanks.
Bye.
Dave and Jeff would like to thank you for listening to the Vet Tech Cafe podcast today. As we talk about difficult issues facing our profession and chat with colleagues who have strong opinions of those issues, we feel it is important to note that the opinions and views expressed by Dave, Jeff, or our guests on the Vet Tech Cafe podcast are solely theirs and theirs alone and do not represent any other person, business, institution, or any other entity. If you have any questions relating to this, please email us at vettechcafe@gmail.com. Thanks again for stopping by the Vet Tech Cafe.